But what you know is going on in there is your brain isn't just getting signals from your spinal cord. Your brain is sending signals down to your spinal cord. Okay, so a bit more about the wiring. You hit one of those painful stimuli, and it is activating the sudden acute pain pathway or the throbbing dull one. Part of what happens then is exclusively in your spinal cord. You've got reflexes where a pain signal comes in, and an instant later, the spinal cord is sending a message to the relevant muscles, get your foot out of that fire. You are not sitting there consciously saying, well, my, that sure feels aversive, and in fact, my toe is roasting. This might be a good time to send a message. Let's see, was it my left toe, big toe, or my right one? Let's send a message there telling it to retract. It's purely spinal reflex. So that's a first level of analysis of a painful input. The next is going on the brain. And it's a level of the brain, a very ancient part of the brain, that's telling you objective information about the source of pain. It's telling you how painful the pain is. It's telling you where the pain is coming from. This is your painometer, telling you how many units of ouchness you've gotten there. This is one that is sending up information saying it's your foot, not your hand, that's gotten injured. This is a bad one. This is a moderate one, whatever. And this activates parts of the brain, which in turn tell other parts to make you start breathing faster and your heart to speed up and maybe to whimper and some of your blood vessels there to constrict, all sorts of autonomic nervous system stuff. So that's a bit of wiring that's in common to all sorts of species out there, including us. Then there's a level on top of it. And this is not the painometer, ancient part of your brain, measuring how many of your toes feel miserable. This is forebrain, more recently evolved parts of the brain, your cortex, in particular an area called the frontal cortex. And what that one plays a role in is evaluating the pain, telling you what you think about it, how you feel about it. And as soon as you're in a world of people who are being in great amounts of pain is wonderful news because they're out of the war, where looking at their loved one feels painful, when you're up there, this is not the painometer part of the brain. This is that forebrain, that frontal cortex, doing evaluative stuff. What does this pain information mean? Now, in order for that to work, we have to return to that diagram, which is in the guidebook, and now we see a very important elaboration. What we've just gone through are circumstances where pain, those parts of the brain that give the subjective evaluative notion of what the pain is about, changes your pain perception. In other words, not only, as promised, is the brain getting pain information coming from the periphery, the brain is sending information back out to the periphery. And as you can see in the diagram here, part C, we've now added in an additional element. We've got the sudden pain inputs, the slow pain inputs, neuron Y, neuron X. Neuron X, when activated, sending information up to the brain, the stuff we all know. But now what we also see is the possibility of projections coming down the spine from the brain, some of which stimulate neuron X, and suddenly the Muzak in the dentist office is making you feel miserable. Some of it coming down, inhibiting neuron X, the evaluative stuff. This is great news. I'm out of the war now. So what we have here is this bidirectionality. Your brain is influencing how sensitive those neurons are to a painful input. So this is the basic wiring about how pain works. So what does stress do on top of it? We've already heard a bit about this in the very first lecture. Massive, painful, stressful stimulus. And this is our zebra with its innards ripped out by the predator. And one of the things that happens is, blessedly, pain perception gets blunted somewhat. Stress-induced analgesia. Analgesia, the inability to feel pain. Severe stress can block some pain perception. And this pops up, this has been documented in all sorts of fascinating ways. For example, you get people who are involved in a serious car accident, and what the literature shows is, above a certain degree of seriousness, 80% of them need morphine as a painkiller. Meanwhile, you look at soldiers in the middle of a battle who get the exact same severity of injury, and the rate, the percentage that need the morphine is vastly lower. What's that about? You have a car accident that comes from out of nowhere, excruciating pain. You get the same injury in the middle of a battle, and the stress of that battle has been producing a roaringly effective case of stress-induced analgesia. And there's much more commonplace circumstances where the same thing happens. You're in the middle of the annual company volleyball game, and you come down and you twist your ankle, and you don't feel it quite as much. That's because, in this case, the stress of the physical activity has induced a certain degree of stress-induced analgesia. So that's a mighty useful thing if you are running away from that lion and you've got that bad injury. How does it work? What are the mechanisms underlying that? And it's actually quite well understood, and a big piece of it has to do with the stress hormone we've heard about a lot in some recent lectures, beta endorphins. Remember, I brought up that point, beta endorphins, they have something to do with pain, but weirdly, here's yet another hormone chemical messenger that does more than one thing. It's got something to do with reproduction, all of that. Now we get to the central arena of what beta endorphin does. And again, going back to its name, what the source of it is, endorphin, endogenous morphine, beta endorphin is the drug that blocks the pain perception, the chemical messenger. And we can once again go back to that diagram to part C, and you look at those projections coming down from the brain. Look at the bottom one, the one that inhibits neuron X, the one that makes neuron X less likely to activate, the one that blunts pain perception. Almost certainly in a lot of these circuits, that projection from the brain makes use of endorphins to block the pain perception. And that's great. That begins to account for the reason why most people who know what beta endorphin is about understand what it does, which is the famed runner's high, your endorphin high. You go out and you decide to run some long distance and it hurts and you're miserable and you're dizzy and you're ready to keel over. And somewhere around 10, 20 minutes into it, suddenly you get this wonderful, gauzy sense of well-being, and it's great. And that's when the endorphins kick in. Mind you, the next day you're going to be miserably sore, but for the moment at least, that's where it's coming from. There's also evidence that acupuncture, when it blocks pain perception, is doing so by stimulating endorphin release. There's also evidence that placebo effects, when one is faked into thinking that you've blocked pain, you're putting a painful stimulus, say something hot on your fingertip, and the subjects are told that they're putting on a cream which blocks pain perception. It actually doesn't really do that. It just causes a placebo effect, and you feel less pain there. And what that placebo effect appears to be about, in a lot of cases, is activating those descending beta endorphin pathways. This finger is screaming with the exact same painful, hot stimulus, and your brain is saying, hey, that doesn't really hurt because after all, we've got this new analgesic cream on our fingertip. That's the brain sending that message down to the neuron X, almost certainly using beta endorphin as the pathway. So now we come into, instead of the realm of acute stress and the activation of beta endorphin and that whole sort of pathway and the acute tapping into that circuit, now what about chronic stress? What about massive chronic stress? And what we get to is truly bad news. Let us return to that diagram yet again. What happens with sustained stress? Major stress is really unpleasant, which is a lot of stimulation of pain pathways make pain pathways more sensitive, more responsive, so that pain begets pain. And you have a phenomenon of hyperalgesia, which is where you have enhanced pain sensitivity. There are some horrible clinical disorders where there's problems in the nervous system, the sort of wiring we've been looking at, where those neurons just fire spontaneously, and thus you are constantly in pain, the hyperalgesia. But one of the things that chronic stress can do is increase the excitability of those neurons. And at an extreme, what you wind up getting is a neuron that actually keeps stimulating itself. Let's look at once again at neuron X, and we've already seen the possibility that a neuron sends its primary projection and then has one of those collateral things that come off. What you can sometimes see is something like a neuron X forms a collateral that loops back on itself, and every time neuron X gets stimulated, it stimulates itself more and more hyperalgesia. And where stress appears to come in, making this possible, is what we've heard about already, the capacity of acute stressors to activate the innate immune response, you remember that from a few lectures ago, to cause inflammation. Inflammation makes pain-mediating neurons more excitable and more likely to get into this vicious circle of pain activation causing pain activation causing pain activation. So now back to where this lecture started, which was going through our usual dichotomy, short-term good news, long-term bad news, and also going back to the very first lecture, going through that notion of Selye's, which turned out to be wrong. Why is it that chronic stress makes you sick? And he came up with that completely incorrect idea that with chronic stress, you go into the exhaustion phase. You run out of the hormones of the stress response. You are depleted of adrenaline, epinephrine. You're depleted of this or that hormone related to stress, and you are pummeled there. And as we saw, this doesn't happen. There is no organism on earth that has been so stressed that it runs out of adrenaline. It simply doesn't happen. This is the one domain where it appears to happen. Because what you get is, with enough pain, with severe enough of pain, with long-lasting enough of pain and stress, what do? You get depleted of beta endorphin. The beta endorphin that comes out of the pituitary, as it turns out, and works on the spine, you get depleted of beta endorphin for a very simple reason. Those cells that are making the beta endorphin, they're dumping so much of the stuff out, and they get just a little bit behind, and they can't quite keep up with demand. So the problem in this case is not the one we've been seeing over and over in lectures, which is the stress response just keeps going for too long, too much prolactin, too much glucocorticoids. The problem here is this rare case of Selye being right in this regard. You run out of the hormone that protects you from the stressor. And what does that mean? That means something really sad and really awful, which is you get that person with a horrendous injury, you get that soldier who's just been shot, you get the woman with a terminal painful cancer, and it's not the case that eventually you turn off the pathways. What eventually happens is you run out of stuff like beta endorphin, and the pain comes back and just keeps going.
Lecture 13, Stress, Learning, and Memory.
Well, no doubt everybody out there is still reeling from the distressing digression we had in the last lecture, away from our usual dichotomy, short-term good news, long-term stress and bad news, in discovering that chronic activation of pain systems, in fact, don't occur. You run out of beta endorphin, that whole fact that we finished with last time. What we do now in this lecture is get back on wonderful, comfortable ground. We're dealing once again with this dichotomy of ours, short-term activation of the stress response, doing a good thing in this case, the theme of this lecture, enhancing learning and memory, chronic stress, doing just the opposite. Now, as with a lot of the other lectures, what we first need to do here is go over the basic workings of the system we're going to talk about. How does memory work? And what we'll do is first look at memory as a behavioral phenomenon, then how memory works at the level of whole sections of the brain, how it works at the level of individual cells, how it works at the level of networks. Now, the first important point here in looking at memory as a behavioral phenomenon is memory is not monolithic. There's not just one type of memory. If you will, there's a whole taxonomy of different types of memory. Short versus long-term versus remote memory, other subcategories. There is one that's going to be quite important here, a dichotomy. between what is called explicit or declarative memory and implicit memory. Explicit declarative memory. You know a fact, and you know that you know the fact. I have a birthday in April. I am a mammal. I have a doctor's appointment next Tuesday. You know the facts sufficiently so that you can actively, consciously behave with that knowledge. Explicit declarative memory. You can declare that piece of information. In contrast, you have the implicit memory. And there's a number of different types of it. One example is what would be called fear conditioning. A type of association, a type of memory that you learn without being conscious, a type of memory, if you will, that your body learns, that you learn implicitly, unconsciously. Let me give you an example of this. I was in the 1989 earthquake in San Francisco, and it was not fun, and it left a lasting impression, an implicit memory that I often find, which is I might be sitting someplace and some large truck rumbles past wherever I'm in, whatever building, and the ground vibrates a little bit, and I stop in my tracks wondering, is this another earthquake? And what that is implicit fear conditioning, because what occurred during the earthquake was 15 seconds or so of the stimulus, 15 seconds that have taught my implicit pathways something indelible. Other types of implicit memory, one that becomes very, very important in all sorts of realms, memory, once again, where your body almost knows better than your head does, just a metaphor, but where it's the memory of how to do things, how to do procedures, how to carry things off, how to do things that are adept and dexterous where you don't have to think about it. And what procedural memory is about is learning to do something automatic. Now, procedural memory comes in all sorts of domains. Like, for example, learning some sort of motoric task, what you initially do is have to deal with it as an explicit declarative piece of information, which then, with practice, transitions over into implicit memory. For example, you are learning some new part of a piece of music on the piano, and there's this difficult trill, and every time you're coming up to it a few measures before, you have this explicit declarative thought, which is, here it comes, remember, tuck in my elbow, lead with my thumb underneath, some such thing, this very explicit process. And then, one day you're playing it, and you suddenly realize, I'm 3 measures past that trill, and I didn't have to think consciously about it. And that's the day that information got moved from an explicit pathway into an implicit one. That's the first time where, in effect, your hands know it better than your head does. So the process of learning some motoric pathway typically takes the route of moving from explicit information to implicit. Something that's interesting is the system is lousy going in the opposite direction, going from implicit knowledge, information, procedural information that you've got to the point your body knows it better than you do, and forcing it back into a declarative channel. And we can see this with a very, very simple experiment, one that you should not carry out alone, which is to walk down a flight of stairs. And right near the bottom, maybe 3 steps from the bottom, think in this declarative, explicit way. So what exactly am I doing when I'm going down a flight of stairs? Am I beginning to shift my weight over to my right knee at this point, or am I still holding something in my left butt? And what's going to happen is you're going to fall down those stairs, because we have not done stairs in an explicit, declarative way since we were about 3 years old. So often, the process of getting new automatic information, going from explicit into implicit pathways, forcing it in the opposite direction is real clunky and doesn't work very well. So now we can transition to the actual brain. What parts of the brain are involved? And take Intro Neuro 101 anytime in the last millennium, and you start off with a part of the brain called the hippocampus. Hippocampus is intensely involved in memory formation. hippocampus. Some Latin name hippocampus means seahorse, which shows you how pathetic neuroanatomists are, because they never get outside the lab, because hippocampus doesn't look like a seahorse at all. It actually looks like a jelly roll, but I guess nobody knows Latin for jelly roll. Hippocampus is this part of the brain that does an aspect of learning for you, of a certain type, of the declarative memory type. And you can see this specialization in a number of different settings. You, for example, can see patterns of brain activation. You put somebody in one of those scanners where you can see what part of the brain is being metabolically active, deal with a new fact, trying to learn it in a declarative way, and it's the hippocampus that activates. Look at something that's already in an implicit, your hands know it better than your head does, procedural way, it's a different part of the brain, the cerebellum, that typically activates. So the hippocampus is about declarative knowledge. You can also see this in a much sadder circumstance. You look at somebody with Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease predominantly damages parts of the cortex and the hippocampus. Demolishes the hippocampus in lots of ways. And what you see with people with early stage Alzheimer's, it's the declarative memory that's shot, the procedural is still good. And that's where you have somebody where he could not tell you what decade it is and where he is, but this retired plumber can still fix a sink trap without even thinking, because that's procedural. So hippocampus and the associated cortex specializing there in declarative memory. Now, this has also been shown in one of the most remarkable incidents and sort of remarkable chapters in all of neurobiology, the story of a man, the only person in all of history where scientists, where doctors intentionally took out his hippocampus. And this was a man who was only known to the literature as HM by his initials, and he is in every textbook. HM in the 1950s had a rare, horribly intractable form of epilepsy that was running amok through his hippocampus. The drugs available at the time weren't controlling it. It was clearly going to kill him, and the very desperate decision was made to go in surgically and remove his hippocampus. That was done, very famous neurosurgeon, and in the aftermath of it, the seizures predominantly went away, it officially worked, and in the aftermath of that, HM's ability to learn new declarative information was very, very much impaired, virtually entirely impaired. Everything he had learned before the surgery, everything filed away, was still intact. He remembered his childhood. He remembered the name of his mother, things of that sort. Everything was there because it was stored someplace other than the hippocampus. It was acquiring new information where things didn't work. There was, say, a 30-second memory span. There wasn't this transition from very fragile short-term memory into more permanent long-term memory because there wasn't a hippocampus. And this was absolutely remarkable to see. I actually met HM once. Of course, he never remembered me. I met HM once. It was when I was doing research in the laboratory at MIT, and he happened to be most intensively studied by some neuroscientists at MIT, and it was one of those like dream moments where you're sitting there in the lab and somebody runs in and says, guess who's out in the hallway? HM, oh my God, let's go meet HM. This is like taking Pavlov's dogs for a walk. So you run out in the hallway, and there's HM, who's this perfectly gregarious man, and he introduces himself, and you shake hands, is saying, hi, my name is Henry, and that's great. And somebody slams a door down the hall, and you glance over, and you look back, and he says, oh, hi, I don't believe we've met. My name is Henry. And you could stand there doing that all day long, utter damage to his declarative memory processes. Now, it was HM that first got people attuned to the fact that there's more than one type of memory. There's this explicit and there's also this procedural. HM could continue to learn procedural tasks. He could learn how to do things with his hands at least as well as any control subject. He simply didn't know he had learned it. So you would give him some puzzle task kind of thing, and because of his explicit memory problem, he had no memory he had done it, and he would say, well, I've never seen this before, but I'll try, I'll do my best. And then he whips through it incredibly fast because he has the procedural memory stored elsewhere. What about HM? In 2009, HM died in his 80s, and people who had been waiting to study his brain for decades moved in at that point. HM, and early in 2010, a virtual religious rite ran through the neuroscience community. The neuroanatomists and neuropathologists who were going to study his brain went through the first step, slicing his brain and mounting the slides to begin to examine the brain tissue microscopically. And in a remarkable event, all of this was broadcast live, streaming video online, where tens of thousands of scientists watched this. And there was something intensely moving about sitting there watching the brain of HM and the involuntary sacrifice of this man for science, watching the brain being sliced. So HM teaching us tons about the hippocampus. Shifting down at this point to the level of individual cells. What's going on with cells and memory? Well, people used to know just what was going on around 1900, which was this view, every time you make a new memory, you make a new brain cell. And that memory is contained in that brain cell, that neuron. That one fell by the wayside very quickly. Then there was a new view there. There are these connections between neurons, technical term synapse, don't worry about it. There's these connections, those cables that we've now seen, say, in the diagram in the last lecture. And the notion there was, learn something new and you form a new connection. And that dominated for a while, except that went by the wayside because that didn't seem to be happening much. And what happened by the 1950s is what came to be the dominant view, a scientist named Donald Hebb. And when talking about memory, if you don't mention Hebb's name, they take away your neurobiology license, because he had the most wonderful dominating insight, the notion that a memory isn't about a new neuron or about a new connection, it's about strengthening pre-existing connections, making those connections more excitable, potentiating those connections, making them more excitable, and potentiating them so that they last long-term. And the jargon in the field winds up being LTP, long-term potentiation. So that's wound up being sort of the dominant model, and an enormous amount of work has gone into figuring out what that LTP, that long-term potentiation, is about. So some sense on the cellular level now. But now a level that's come to be really interesting to lots of researchers in the field, the notion of networks of neurons storing memory. Okay, so that Donald Hebb view, that memory is about you stimulate a pathway over and over, you learn something, and you then change the excitability of this synapse, and that's where the memory is. A single memory is not stored in a single connection between neurons. Instead, it's stored in networks. And the whole notion of these networks is information is diffusely distributed. Information, a memory, is not contained in any single neuron or any single connection. It's contained in patterns of activation. And what you see is a characteristic of memory which absolutely proves how it's contained in networks. You're sitting there in a party, and you're trying to remember the name of that person sitting across from you, and you can't remember their name, and what you begin to do is try to pull out that memory by association. How many syllables does that person's name have? I'm remembering it starting with a B sound. Let's see, where was I when I learned that person's name? Who is I with? You're tapping into associations. You're tapping into the people with this number of syllables in their name network, and people who have their name starting with B, and people who I met in this setting, and somewhere at the intersection of all those networks, that name will suddenly pop out. And that's what memory, that's what pulling out something is often about in terms of these networks. And what that begins to explain is something remarkable you could see with Alzheimer's disease, which is early on in the disease, it's not that memories are lost, it's harder to pull them out. It's harder to evoke them. And you can see this in all sorts of ways. You get somebody where, for example, you are trying to tap into their orientation to space and time. You have an Alzheimer's patient and you will give them an orientation test. You will say, well, do you know what the date is? Do you know where you are? Do you know how many children you have? The name of your spouse? Some such thing. And then you will ask them a question, one which is pertinent right now when this is being taped, which is to ask them, oh, and do you know the name of the former president? Not there. Completely gone. They can't evoke it. And now what you do is prove that that information is not contained in a single neuron that died, that the information is in a network. You begin to tap into the intersection between that network and other ones. You prime the person. You say, okay, let me help you out a little bit. The name was one syllable. Nothing. Doesn't come out. So then you give him a little stronger priming, tapping into yet another network, saying, okay, it's a one syllable word and it's something you might encounter in a park. Nope, doesn't come out. Then you give them the strongest type of priming. You actually force them to choose. You say, okay, so was it President Bench, President Tree, President Shrub, President Bush, Bush, that's right, the kid, the son, Bush, President Bush, and out it pops, showing this characteristic early on in Alzheimer's. It's not that the memory is lost. It has taken more work to pull it out of the networks because the networks have lost neurons. The networks have weakened. So that gives a sense about how memory works at the level of whole regions of the brain, the hippocampus, and it's not just the hippocampus, but hippocampus being very notable for this declarative memory. What's going on down at the cellular level? Memory does not consist of making new neurons, does not consist of making new connections, but strengthening pre-existing ones, and how those strengthened connections play out over the course of lots of neurons, networks of neurons, making those connections with each other. Ironic ending department, it turns out, that ancient, laughable notion that memory consists of making new neurons, or even memory consists of making new connections, that's ridiculous. That's medieval neuroscience. In the last few years, there's increasing evidence that that actually does occur some of the time. A huge revolution in neurobiology has occurred. For the last, centuries, if you're learning basic neurobiology, one of the facts that gets hammered in immediately is the adult brain doesn't make new neurons. You're stuck with whatever number you got early on, and all that happens from there is you go downhill with fewer of them. This revolution being that it turns out the adult brain, even in humans, does make new neurons, adult neurogenesis. And remarkably, the place in the brain where it happens the most is in, you guessed it, the hippocampus. And at this stage, there's beginning to be evidence that certain types of memory acquisition require the formation of new neurons. So here we have both learning the lessons of history and having it repeat on you. Here we are back again, the notion that some of memory formation actually involves forming new neurons or forming new connections, as it turns out. Nonetheless, the bulk of what goes on appears to be that strengthening of pre-existing neurons. Okay, so we've got basic memoryology under our belt here at the systems level, networks, individual cells. So what happens with stress? What happens? You know exactly what happens, which is short term, you have memory enhanced. Short term, stress does great things for your learning and memory. And we saw that starting in the very first lecture. Short term, what do? You increase the delivery of oxygen to the brain. You increase the delivery of glucose. Those are exactly the sorts of things that make for a perkier brain that is more able to do the very energetically costly process of all that excitation business. What's that due to? That's the increased heart rate, blood pressure. You dilate, you loosen up some of the blood vessels in critical areas of the brain, deliver the oxygen, glucose up there, and suddenly you got a brain that works better. What else? With the onset of stress, you suddenly have those neurons that undergo that long-term potentiation business, that business about these connections becoming more excitable in the hippocampus, and suddenly LTP happens more readily. And this could then be shown on the level of actual learning and memory, the sort of thing where you look at, does a stressor make it easier to remember certain things? And this was shown in a magnificently elegant study carried out by two scientists, Larry Cahill and James McGaw, University of California, Irvine. McGaw, one of the senior figures in the field. And here's the study they did. Totally elegant. You take a bunch of control volunteers, and what you do is you tell them this 12-sentence story. Boy and his mother go walking through town. They pass the grocery store. They pass the hardware store. They cross the street. They go into the hospital where the mother works there. The mother shows the boy how the x-ray machine works and on. The first four sentences being, they cross the street up to that point, then in the hospital. So that's the first version. The second version, the experimental subjects, what happens with them is, one part of the story is different. A boy and his mother are walking through town. They pass the grocery store. They pass the hardware store. They begin to cross the street when the boy is struck by a huge truck, and the boy is rushed to the hospital where they rush him to the x-ray room and x-ray him in this big... You'll notice the first four sentences are the same, and then it goes into a much more emotionally arousing, a much more stressful story. And what Cahill and McGaw showed was, come back a couple of weeks later and see what people remember about the story. The people who got the first boring version, the mother goes and shows the kid the x-ray machine, they don't remember it very well. You get the people who got the much more stressful, emotionally arousing version, and they remember it better. But the part they remember better is starting when the child is hit by the truck. That's the arousing, stressful part. That's the part that gets filed away as suddenly the oxygen and the glucose is coursing up into the brain. So what causes this to happen? This has some responsiveness, some involvement of glucocorticoids, some involvement of the sympathetic nervous system predominantly, and in the final elegant touch to the study, they showed exactly how the sympathetic nervous system plays that role, which is they gave these volunteer experimental subjects a little bit of a drug which blocks activation of the sympathetic nervous system. A drug which blocks a certain type of receptor for epinephrine, adrenaline, and this is a drug lots of people have heard of and use. It's called a beta blocker. Beta blockers tone down sympathetic tone, drugs like propranolol. And what they did at this point is they either had people get a placebo and hear the horrifying, really distressing, stressful version of the story, or people who were given a beta blocker and heard the same story. In other words, they went into hearing the really upsetting part of the story with their sympathetic nervous system damped down. And those folks didn't have preferential memory of that event. What that's telling you is this short-term enhancement of memory driven by the sympathetic nervous system is, number one, specific to the more arousing parts of the memory and, as just shown with that experiment, yes, indeed, involves the sympathetic nervous system. So we've got our short-term response to stress, a 30-second story. Now we switch over to our more chronic scenario of stress. More chronic, and what you begin to see, as we would absolutely guess, is a more sustained stressor disrupts memory. A more sustained stressor, how would you show that in lab rats? They have to learn some sort of maze, that kind of thing. How do you show it in humans? All sorts of experimental settings. You force somebody to go through a stressor, like giving a public speech, and then afterward you see how well they remember something from beforehand. And, you know, that might be viewed as stressful in this case, but fortunately I'm a computer-generated image. But for most people, doing something like this, you would begin to disrupt memory, because it's stressful. What do you see? Once stress is going on for a few hours or so, no longer are you delivering more glucose and oxygen to the brain, you're delivering less. No longer are you enhancing LTP, that long-term potentiation, you're disrupting LTP. And exactly where you don't want to have it disrupted, in the hippocampus. Next, you actually, with more sustained stress, begin to do something remarkable, which is you change the structure of neurons in the hippocampus. You cause them to atrophy. You cause them to atrophy, those long processes. We've been hearing all about those long processes with which a neuron talks to another neuron. What are you doing there? You're disconnecting circuits. So suddenly, what circuits there are not very excitable, disrupting that long-term potentiation, and you're making for fewer connections because you're disconnecting, you're atrophying these neurons. But oh, that's not enough. More things go wrong. Back to that revolution in neurobiology, back to that finding that the adult brain, the adult hippocampus, can make new neurons. When does that occur? In response to all the logical things. Learning something new, environmental stimulation, exercise, very interestingly, estrogen as well, a whole bunch of things that stimulate neurogenesis. And the two surest ways to shut down neurogenesis, lots of glucocorticoids and lots of stress. So that's another domain in which you pay a price. Then, moving on to a next realm, what you have with sustained stress, and glucocorticoids play this role, is you endanger neurons in the hippocampus. You take hippocampal neurons and you make them a little fragile and a little bit wimpy and a little bit nauseous and green around the gills. What you do is you take a hippocampal neuron and you put it right on the edge of a cliff during sustained stress. At that point, if nothing else happens, the neuron recovers, everyone lives happily ever after. If at that point, though, you push the neuron with something else, it's that much more likely to go over the edge. And what this endangerment translates into is stress and glucocorticoids make it harder for neurons in the hippocampus to survive things like a stroke, a seizure, things of that sort. So you suddenly have chronic stress potentially worsening neurological outcomes. And this is actually an area of research that my lab has spent the last 25 years on, trying to understand what this endangerment is about. Finally, at the greatest extreme, with massive amounts of exposure to stress or glucocorticoids, you apparently are able to actually kill neurons in the hippocampus. And this was originally shown in rodents, and again, I was involved in some of this work, and subsequent to that, shown to be involved in non-human primates, and thus we move to the critical, disturbing question, what about humans? Can sustained stress disrupt LTP? Can sustained stress in humans cause atrophy of neurons? Can sustained stress make neurons in the human hippocampus more fragile, more likely to be done in by insults? Does sustained stress actually kill hippocampal neurons in humans? And this is where we're going to pick up in the next lecture. And all I can leave you with at this point is the news is not good.
Lecture 14, Stress, Judgment, and Impulse Control.
We now continue the previous lecture, the lecture about stress and memory, and we finished that lecture with a very disturbing, provocative question. You'll recall in the final minutes of that lecture, what we focused on was the consequences of major long-term stress for the brain, for the memory systems in the brain, and we saw lots of bad news. Chronic stress and the declarative memory that the hippocampus specializes in disrupted. Chronic stress, less oxygen, less glucose delivery to the brain. You begin to disrupt long-term potentiation, that increase in excitability. You begin to cause atrophy of neurons in the hippocampus. You suppress neurogenesis, that wonderful new phenomenon. You make it harder for neurons to survive all sorts of insults. And at an extreme, you can actually kill neurons. So the question we were left with there is, what about humans? How much of this applies to the human brain? And much of this is impossible to study in humans. Not like you could study in laboratory animals, as described before, because you can't tell if individual neurons are atrophying in the human brain. You can't detect whether there is long-term potentiation in particular connections between neurons. But one thing you can do that's quite pertinent is to take advantage of brain imaging techniques. Ones where you put somebody in a scanner and you can see the size of different structures of the brain, the level of activity, CAT scans, MRIs, things of that sort. And what you can do with those approaches is look at the size of the hippocampus. And what those studies have provided are the starts of some pretty disturbing conclusions. What we know by now is what's going on, an awful lot of those sources, chronic stress causing atrophy, neuronal damage, all this stuff in the lab animals, is a function of the excessive exposure to glucocorticoids. So we start off with the first domain of humans where there is excessive exposure to glucocorticoids. Back to the immunology lecture, that whole business about what glucocorticoids can do is suppress immunity, and that business that when you have an immune system that spirals out of control into autoimmunity, glucocorticoids are good for coasting you back again. And as a result, there are hundreds of thousands of people out there taking high-dose glucocorticoids, synthetic versions, long-term to control their lupus, another autoimmune disease, their rheumatoid arthritis, whatever. And suddenly, you come up with the inevitable question, do folks like these begin to have the sort of memory problems that are associated with hippocampal dysfunction? Now, these are extremely tough studies to do because, by definition, if you are marinating somebody in synthetic glucocorticoids, it's because they've got a serious disease. And if there's cognitive problems, is it due to the disease? Is it due to the steroids? And it has taken some very subtle, difficult studies, case control studies, where you match two people for age, education, gender, all of that, and the severity of the disease. And you take ones where it's been treated over the years with non-glucocorticoid, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs versus steroidal glucocorticoid ones, and then look at memory, and just the first hints of a literature showing the more glucocorticoid exposure, the more problems you have with hippocampal type memory. So that's not good. Moving to the next version, that of relevance to humans, a disease, in fact, a syndrome of diseases called Cushing's disease, Cushing's syndrome. Any of a number of different types of tumors where the commonality is you secrete boatloads of glucocorticoids. And you've got all of the side effects that are associated by now, diabetes, hypertension, all that sort of thing. And inevitably, one then has to ask, what's going on up in the brain? Do you get the sorts of memory problems associated with a hippocampus that is not doing its best? Yes, indeed. It's often called Cushingoid dementia. And what about the hippocampus in terms of structure? First brain imaging studies some years ago showing that long-term chronic people with Cushing's disease, typically people have Cushing's for about 2 years before it's diagnosed, major long-term Cushingoid bathing in glucocorticoids, and you get atrophy of the hippocampus. The more prolonged, the more severe the glucocorticoid excess, the more hippocampal atrophy. Now, is this due to dead neurons? Almost certainly not, because equally interesting studies have shown if you then go in and surgically correct the tumor, get rid of the excess glucocorticoids, over the next year or so, the hippocampus comes back to normal volume. What's this about? This is almost certainly that atrophy of individual neurons, because what the laboratory studies show is with the abatement of stress, with the abatement of glucocorticoid exposure, the processes grow back. So the hippocampus is able to shrink and seemingly some capacity to recover, and the memory processes come back to normal. Now, the next human version is truly profoundly troubling, which is an emerging literature, well-replicated studies showing that chronic major league depression can be associated with hippocampal atrophy. As already alluded to, and as what will fill up two different lectures, Depression has much to do with stress. Depression is intertwined in many cases with glucocorticoid excess. And what these studies have shown is atrophy of the hippocampus. The more prolonged the depression history, the more atrophy, the more memory problems. Is this reversible? To date, the majority of studies have shown that it's not. With the abatement of the depression, when it's gotten under control with the correct antidepressants, when the depression goes away, you don't necessarily get full recovery of hippocampal volume. Caveat, fine print here, have a depressive period, do not get into a fraught state here of worry, no evidence yet that everyday clinical depression can cause this. This is horrendous, massive, serious depression associated with this. Next version that might be relevant, a human disease, a disease of people with horrible exposure to stress, some traumatic incident producing PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And what is seen there in a large number of studies from recent years is, once again, atrophy, loss of volume of the hippocampus, preferentially the hippocampus, and the more severe the traumatic history, the more atrophy, the more memory problems. Now, this happens to be a wildly controversial, incendiary subject built around this confusing issue, depression. Very often elevated glucocorticoid levels. Cushing's disease, by definition, elevated glucocorticoid levels. Give somebody synthetic glucocorticoids and you raise their glucocorticoid levels. It remains very controversial whether PTSD is associated with elevated glucocorticoid levels or remarkably lower than normal levels. And mixed results in the literature, it's not entirely clear what's going on. Nonetheless, in the cases where it's below normal levels, what you see is enhanced sensitivity to the glucocorticoids. So the PTSD story is quite confused at this point, but what is far clearer is the evidence that lots of synthetic glucocorticoids, excess glucocorticoids in Cushing's disease, excess glucocorticoids in the severe cases of depression, you get loss of volume of the hippocampus. The more severe the insult, the more volume loss, and the more problems with the sort of memory that the hippocampus specializes in. Okay, disturbing bad news, but this is disturbing bad news at some of the extremes of things that can go wrong. Tumors, major depression, all of that. What about more everyday stressors? What about, for example, chronic occupational stressors? And there was a remarkable, fascinating study that was done some years ago, published in the journal Nature, which is probably the most prestigious journal in the world. And what this was about was looking at people with a certain occupational stress. These were flight attendants for two different airlines, both of them that do intercontinental flights, and the two airlines happen to differ after you do an intercontinental flight with a massive switch of circadian cycle inducing dramatic jet lag. How many days do you get off from intercontinental flights in order to recover? And there was the nice airline where you had 15 days to recover. And then there was the mean stepmother airline where you had 5 days to recover. And what the study showed, and it was perfectly done, controlling for the total number of time shifts that somebody had done professionally as a flight attendant. So it's not that one group had more of these shifts. The two groups merely differed in recovery time, and what was shown was those folks working for the airline that gave you only the 5 days to recover, smaller hippocampus and more memory problems. What I thought was very interesting, actually two things. One was that the paper carefully went about not mentioning the names of these airlines, because I assume if they had mentioned the 5 day one, they would have gotten their like keisters sued off for this. The other was, it struck me somewhere in there, that also undergoing all of those time shift stressors are the pilots. And they were unmentioned in the study, but it seems kind of disturbing. I mean, it's bad enough to get the memory problems where you can't remember if the person wants ice cubes in the milk or not. But if you're getting problems like you can't remember if this little old switch goes up or down in the cockpit there, this is not a good thing. Nonetheless, first evidence that occupational stress can have some of the same consequences. Finally, the realm of normative aging. And this is wonderful work done by a neuroscientist, Sonia Lupien, at the University of Montreal. And what she has done is look at what glucocorticoids might have to do with successful aging. A subject that will come with an entire lecture, but just briefly foreshadowing here, in this study of hers, she took 70-year-old individuals and characterized them at that point, the size of their hippocampus, brain imaging, their glucocorticoid levels, and then came back 5 years later. And what she saw was, for those people whose glucocorticoid levels have risen over those 5 years, they tended to lose hippocampal volume and tended to get more memory problems. So at this point, this is a very preliminary literature. Nonetheless, it suggests all the bad news of the last lecture in terms of what chronic stress, chronic glucocorticoids can do to memory processes might very well apply to our own brains. Now we transition to the other topic in this lecture, which is the fact that your brain is not just good for playing the piano and going down flights of stairs, and your brain is not just good for learning and memory, your brain is also good for judgment, for impulse control, for executive decisions, and all of this involves a part of the brain briefly mentioned, a part of the brain that is so interesting called the frontal cortex. The frontal cortex is absolutely fascinating. Cortex, the surface of the brain, frontal cortex, the surface in the front of the brain. The frontal cortex is such an interesting part of the brain. I have spent the last 25 years of my life studying the hippocampus. The hippocampus has been good to me. I love the hippocampus, but I've become badly infatuated with the frontal cortex in recent years because it does such interesting stuff. Yes, learning and memory is cool. The frontal cortex, though, is amazing. The frontal cortex is arguably the most human part of the brain. Proportionately, we've got more complex frontal cortices than any other species out there. It's the most recently evolved part of the brain. Frontal cortex, a big-time frontal cortex, is virtually a primate invention. We're humans really running with it. What does the frontal cortex do? All sorts of complicated things, regulating executive behaviors and strategizing. On the very simplest level, what does the frontal cortex do? It makes you do the harder thing when it's the right thing to do. It makes you do something that's difficult when that's what you should be doing. The frontal cortex, okay, you want some terrible, utterly inapplicable metaphor. Frontal cortex is the nearest thing we've got to a superego, the nearest thing to a part of the brain saying, I wouldn't do that if I were you, you were going to regret it. The frontal cortex has this role manifest in all sorts of domains. For example, the frontal cortex makes you at a party do the right thing even though it's harder. You've just been served the most horrendous meal you can ever imagine, and it's your frontal cortex that kicks in that says, whoa, this is delicious, I've got to have the recipe. The frontal cortex is what gets you to compliment somebody's hideous new hairdo. The frontal cortex keeps you from being a serial murderer. It keeps you constrained. It keeps you in line. The frontal cortex is also something that kicks in a very dramatic way during early development. Most of us way back when had to suddenly get a lot of frontal function when we learned to be toilet trained. And that is something that soon moved from frontal executive control to implicit pathways. Most of us don't have to think consciously anymore about being toilet trained, but early on, that was one of the big initial frontal tasks that we had to master. Okay, so frontal cortex. Frontal cortex, all sorts of fascinating other features of it. And as just became clear, part of development, child development, is your frontal cortex maturing. And you can show the fact that kids don't have a whole lot in the way of a frontal cortex by brain imaging, things of that sort, and you find out something absolutely astonishing. The frontal cortex is the last part of the brain to fully develop. Your frontal cortex is not fully developed until around age 25. That is astonishing. That explains an awful lot of behavior in freshman dorms. That explains all sorts of things. The frontal cortex takes forever to develop, and thus childhood is filled with a frontal cortex that doesn't work very well yet. you can show this wonderful study, this wonderful experimental paradigm, where you take kids, and what you do is you put the child in a room, and you put a marshmallow in front of them, and you say, okay, here's the deal. I'm going out of the room, I'm going to come back in a while, and if you want, while I'm out of the room, you can have that marshmallow. On the other hand, if you don't eat it, when I come back, you can have two marshmallows. In other words, can you regulate your behavior, regulate this impulsive desire to grab that marshmallow? And kids very early on are awfully, awfully challenged in order to hold on and not grab the marshmallow early on. And in fact, there is a literature by now showing you take like four-year-olds, and the longer they can hold on not taking the marshmallow, the more frontal regulation they have of their behavior. And that is in part predictive of things like SAT scores a decade later in high school. This is the mark of a frontal cortex that is developing in a very impressive manner. Although, as a parent, what I've discovered is there's a much easier way of measuring the degree of frontal development, which is play hide and seek with a child. Here's what happens. You're playing hide and seek, and the kid is hiding, and you count up to 10, and you come into the room, and you say, ready or not, here I come. Ooh, where are you? And suddenly the kid says, I'm right here under the piano, because they can't stop themselves from saying where they are, because they got like no frontal cortex. Or you now